Right now, so we're on week five of the Chase the Lion series, and we've kind of been going through. We took a little bit of deviation from the book. Those of you who have the book, by the way, one copy left. If anybody wants it, it's in the back. But we deviated a little bit because I wanted to watch the evolution of a hero of God, and so we started watching Gideon, and this is our third week. We're going to finish it up this week. Last week we ended up at this one place in Judges where Gideon had tested the Lord. Now the Bible tells us don't do this, and we talked about that last week. But he was nervous. I mean, poor Gideon was kind of like, he said, "I'm the least son of the smallest family of the smallest tribe in Israel." So you know he has a very, very low self-esteem and a little bit of an inferiority complex. And because of that, he was very nervous about this whole idea that I'm going to be leading a battle. He's never fought. He knows nothing about battle. And so God allowed him to test him, which God tells you don't do. But God allowed him to do it because he needed his buy-in. He needed Gideon to be all in. And you'll see why in a minute, because God's going to have Gideon do some bizarre things. And if he doesn't have his trust down up front, we're never going to get to the next stage. Let's just deal with this now. And so there's a very famous scene called Laying Out a Fleece. And we talked about that in last week's sermon, which is online. And after that mini miracle that God performs for him, literally in his backyard, a little kind of personal miracle, Gideon says, okay, that's it. We're going to go. We're picking up the story right there. So Gideon and all the people who were with him rose early and camp beside the spring of Herod, and the camp of the Midian was on the north side of them over the hill of Morah in the valley. And I was just thinking about this. This is pretty amazing because all Gideon has done, his entire claim to fame at this point in his life, was he tore down an altar of Baal that was in his dad's house, like on a high place. His dad had put an altar to Baal. All of them had, by the way. But he tore down Baal's altar. The city came to stone him, and his dad says, no. That's not going to happen. And the whole city backed down. And somehow from this, his fame spread throughout the land. See, that tells me that the entire kingdom of Israel was already nervous about this building Baal altars. There was something in their spirit was telling them it was wrong, but no one had the nerve to do anything. But one man did. And he set this electric shock through the entire kingdom. One man did the right thing. Sometimes people are waiting for one person to do the right thing, and that person might be you. And so that's what happens. And I thought, this is pretty good, though. In a land of no social media, he suddenly has 32,000 followers. You know, that's a pretty good Twitter account, really. So suddenly he has 32,000 people. They show up from nowhere. This is what we talked about last week. He blew the trumpet, and his army shows up. They send messengers out. 32,000 people assemble to fight. The problem, of course, is that Midians have about 132,000. That's not very good odds. But they all showed up, and they didn't know why, except they heard this man, they've heard of this man, the Gideon. He sounded the war horn, and they showed up. And I think maybe some of them showed up as much to see who Gideon was as anything, but now he's leading them down, and they get there, and they suddenly see how big the enemy is. And now things get a little dicey. It's like, well, it was all fun and games when we're talking about the war, but we just got here, and we've met the enemy, and they're huge. You know, they're way bigger than we are here. So the Lord says to Gideon, you know what? The people who are with you are too many. So they're outnumbered like, you know, somewhere around 5-1 at this point. And God says, yeah, you guys have too many. Can you imagine Gideon like, wait a minute, God's talking to me. Wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. I need to go talk to God for a second. Sidebar. He goes to the office and says, God, I think you mean they're too many. We're outnumbered 5-1 here. I don't know if you're watching the right side here. No. He says, no, that's not enough. If you win this battle, you're all going to take credit for it. You're going to say, my own power has delivered me. Because battles have been won with 5-1 odds. You know, it's not that uncommon. You know, usually numbers carry the day, but not always. There are some very famous battles where the people were outnumbered 5-1, and they won, you know. And what always happens, you talk about the glory of the commanders and the bravery of the people and the you know, how great soldiers they are. God said, I can't have that. When this is over, I want everybody to know I'm the one who did it. Now, I know that a lot of people think, because I talked, especially non-believers, that God's this egomaniac. Boy, God just has to take all the credit all the time, doesn't he? Like he always wants it. There's a reason why God says, I have to be known as the one who delivered you, and it's this. God needs to be our deliverer because our strength fails. See, if you're strong and you're fast and you're a great fighter and you win the battle, that's great, but your strength will fail. You'll get sick, you'll get older, you'll get slower. And if you have a battle and Gideon turns out to be this brilliant leader, that's great, but Gideon won't stay forever. We had Moses, we had Joshua. You know, eventually the leaders will leave. God says, I need to deliver you so you know I'm here. Because I'm always here. I don't get old. I don't get slow. I don't grow dim of speech or dim of thought. I am eternal. I'm the same today as I was when I created the world, and I'll be the same 100,000 years from now. I don't change. And so if God delivers us, we can rest. If we got lucky in a battle, then we have to worry about getting lucky the next time. So he says, I need for everybody to know, because I'm stepping up here, I need everybody to know that I did the delivery. So I'm going to now tell you what to do. In Psalm 73, this is by the way, we talk about Bible translations. This is not the one we normally use, but I love the way they phrase it here. My health may fail, my spirit may grow weak, but God remains the strength of my heart, and he is mine forever. That's basically what God's saying. Your strength will fail. You know, it's okay. Your spirit grows weak. Your heart gets faint. But I'm here to strengthen your heart, and I'm here forever. So that's what God's telling Gideon. So we're going now start winnowing out a number of these, right? So how many of you think God's going to take? Well, he says, go and proclaim in the hearing of the people, whoever's afraid and trembling, let him return home. So you're going to walk. He says, look, this army's a little stronger than you thought it was. If you're scared right now, you can pick up and go away. And Gideon thought, okay, that's good. And I'm sure he's expecting two or three people to leave. You know, like, remember the story of the Alamo? They drew the line. Everybody crosses the line. You know, I think he's waiting for this. It's kind of his moment. You know, he's going to say, I'm going to do it. And everybody says, no, for God and for Gideon, we're staying. You know, instead this happens. Gideon had spoken, 22,000 people left him and returned to their homes. 22,000, two-thirds of his army gets up and leaves. And so here's the thing about this. Fear doesn't just keep us from winning the battle. Fear will keep us from fighting the battle. And we have to worry about that a little bit in our lives because we're fearful. And there's sometimes God's calling us into battle. And it's not just that we won't win. We won't fight if we're afraid. And God knows this. This is why in Deuteronomy, way back before this, here's what he told Moses to say. The officer shall speak to the people and say, who is the man that's afraid and faint-hearted? Well, then let him depart and return to his house, so he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his heart. So that's contagious. Fear is contagious. Have you noticed that? Have you been in a situation with in a group of people or something, and suddenly one person says, well, you know what's going to happen? And they start voicing their fears, and suddenly, oh, I didn't think of that. And fear spreads very fast. God says, I'm not going to have fear contaminating my army. If you're scared, go home. I don't need you anyway. What I need is some people who trust me. And so that's what Gideon had found out. He found out that only 10,000 people trusted him. And so 22,000 people go home. That must have been really great. The odds are now 10 to 1. 10 to 1. All right, now we're ready to fight, right? No, God says it's still too many. And this is why he had to have Gideon's buy-in, right? Because what he's about to do next, any other leader's like running away at this point. Find someone else. He said, I want you to bring down the water and I will test them. You like testing, right? Remember Gideon, how you tested me? Now I'm going to test the army. And it will be, of he that I say to you, this one will go with you, he'll go with you. But everyone who says to you, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go with you. So here's what's going to happen. We're going to go down to the water. And I'm going to test them, and I'm going to decide which ones go with you and which one doesn't. God sends you on your mission with the people he chooses. Now, if God's calling you into a ministry of any kind, you can rest assured he's not calling you into it alone. He always brings people. The Spirit goes with you, and he brings people with you to help, but he'll choose the people. And, you know, not to disparage my leadership here at Spirit Chapel, but I wouldn't have picked the leadership that I have at Spirit Chapel. I wouldn't have picked them, and I'm sure they wouldn't have picked me. You know, that's kind of the way it works. And so God chooses the people, and there's many, many reasons why he chooses the people that he chooses. Sometimes he chooses the people to put in leadership positions because he's trying to teach them how to be leaders. That's what's true of Gideon. Gideon becomes a leader. He doesn't start a leader. You know, by the time David arrives on the battlefield with Goliath, he's pretty much fully cooked. You know, God has spent his time with him, and he's ready to be a leader. But not many of them are. Usually, God has to kind of work with them in progress. It's on-the-job training with God most of the time. I'm always pleased when someone comes up and says, man, I've learned so much since Spirit Chapel's opened. I'm thinking, that's great, but I've learned way more than you. I promise you. God's taught me more than anybody else here. He put me here to teach me. That's why I'm here, and I get that. And so God will choose who goes with you, and he has his purposes in mind, and they may come along for a season, or they may come along and not be what you expected, but all of a sudden they will do things like, wow, I would have never thought of that. God has his army for you. He does. He's already picked it. You just don't know who they are yet. So here's what happens. He says, look, separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink. Now, when I was a kid, we used to play outside all day long, and there was a creek that ran up kind of behind our house, and we got thirsty, and we drink out of it. We probably shouldn't have. It was really, really probably shouldn't have drunk that water. But I drank both ways, you know, depending on a lot of things, you know. Sometimes I'd get on my, you know, hands and knees, and I just put my face in the water, you know, and sometimes I'd lap it up, whatever. I'd go either way. It's not like a person's good or bad or evil if they drink the wrong way. All God wants to do right now is he wants to come up with a specific number of people that he has in mind. Now, the number of those who lapped by putting their hand to their mouth was 300 men, but all the rest of the people knelt to drink the water. May I introduce to you the original 300. By the way, about 1,000 years before the Greeks did it, God picked 300 men to go into battle. Interestingly enough, by the way, just not for nothing, but these people actually win their battle. You know, the Spartans' famous stand was a loss. And oh, by the way, there was more than 300 people there. There were just 300 Spartans there, for those of you history buffs. But anyway, the Lord said to Gideon, okay, I will deliver you with these 300 men, and I will give the Midianites into your hands. Okay, 130,000, 300. I don't think anybody's going to take credit for this one when it's over, will they? You know? So Gideon's like, okay. I don't know what you're doing, God, but I promised you after that second fleece thing that I'd trust you. But he's probably walking home thinking, I should have come up with a third test. I can see that now. I should have seen something. Fire from heaven would be good right now. I would like to do that. So all the other people went home. So the 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets into their hands. That's going to become important in a second. And Gideon sends the other men home, but retained the 300, and the camp of Midian was below them in the valley. So here's the setup. 300 people. Well, we got it right where we want them. That's a good thing is, you know, you swing your sword, you're bound to hit a Midian. You know, it's we're surrounded. But God plus one makes an unbeatable army. He doesn't care about the numbers. He could do it with Gideon alone. In fact, God could do it alone, but he needs someone there to witness his goodness. Right? So he needs a witness. Yeah, Gideon, come on, you and I will go take him on. He's done it. He did that before. He put the entire Philistine army in a rout because David, he's taken down an army with one guy before. He could do it with one. He picked 300. He's actually giving Gideon some help. You know, so we're going to go fight this. But we know this. We kind of understand this. We understand God's unbeatable, so God plus one makes me unbeatable. But this isn't just in battle. And we have to kind of get a picture here that God is sufficient. The one name that came up here, El Shaddai, that's what that means. God is sufficient. God is sufficient for you. He who has God and everything else has no more than he who has God only. It's a quote from C.S. Lewis. And we like to think about it in terms of this, but he means it in terms of everything. Everything that we think we need in life to be successful, to be happy, or to be successful Christians, we don't need them. What we need is God. What we need is God. God is everything. You can't add anything to everything and increase it. You just can't. And so, by definition, God is everything. And he's saying, I'm all you need. Me, that's it. We can go to any battle and win because I'm with you. That's all it takes. What are you thinking you need besides God? Because sometimes we're held back. I can't go because I can't speak well enough. You know, that was Moses' excuse. I stutter. And God's reply was, I made your mouth. What else you got? You know, and everybody, you know, has reasons why they can't go forward. You know, Gideon says, I'm the least son. I don't care. I'm the greatest God. Let's go. You know, it doesn't matter to God what your excuse is, but sometimes we let our excuses keep us from going. I'm not going to do this because I'm afraid of this because of this. And God says, I'm the winner here. You're just coming along to witness. Let's go. We're unbeatable. The two of us together, we're unbeatable. Okay, so that same night, but I want to show you something because God is so gracious to Gideon here. The Lord comes and says, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands. You're 300 men. Go. And Gideon's like looking at him. He says, but if you're afraid to go down, because he knows Gideon's afraid to go down, Gideon's still Gideon, right? He's like, God, I don't know. I don't know how to charge 150,000 with 300 or whatever. Just go down with your servant first. Just the two of you go down to the line. You know. Now, God's not calling him to attack. Thank God. He says, you're going to hear something that's going to change. I'm going to send you down there. I'm going to let you hear something that's going to strengthen your heart, and then you're going to know that I'm here and the battle's yours. Wow, that's kind of exciting. Okay, that's good. You're going to show me something. What could God possibly tell him? What is he going to hear when he goes down there and listens in, you know, their little spy trip down here? But they go, so they go on down. But God does not choose us for our strengths. He chooses us for our heart. There was something in Gideon's heart that he saw. There was something there that made him pick Gideon. Same reason he picked David. He chooses for our heart. But here's what we need to understand. Our weaknesses don't worry God. He knows them. He knows who Gideon is. He knew who Gideon was before he chose him. I know you're scaredy cat, Gideon. Come on. I'm going to make you strong. I'm going to make you a mighty warrior. Don't worry. I got a plan for that. I'm going to strengthen your heart. But a lot of times we think, well, I got this problem. But here's the other thing. Your weaknesses come out in your ministry. They do. You don't instantly get better the minute God calls you to ministry. Your weaknesses will come out. It's okay. God's expecting it. And he's got a way of strengthening it. And part of this whole deal is he's fixing that. Right? So we just stop kind of holding back because we know our weaknesses. Believe me, God knows them better than we do. So Gideon and his servant goes down to the outpost of the army, and now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley, and they were as numerous as locusts, or cicadas, as we all know. Those things get numerous and loud, right? And their camels were without number. So they had, by the way, they had cavalry, they had supplies, they had all kind of stuff, and the Israelites, you know, have swords, that's it. They don't even have chariots. But they were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. And when Gideon came, behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend. I love this dream. He says this, behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of the Midians. I see this loaf of bread coming down the hill. A loaf of bread, right? All right. And it came to the tent, the Midian tent, and struck it, so it fell and turned upside down and went flat. He says, isn't that a weird dream? Now, I want you to see his friend's instant interpretation of this. I think this is an angel Lord sent there, because this interpretation is the wildest thing. He said, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. It's like, you know, what? You know, if a piece of barley bread coming over the hill wipes out a tent, oh, that means God's with Gideon. He's going to kill us all. And this is amazing to me. But fear has already begun to set into the Midian camp. That's what that shows me. And Gideon must have been giggling. You know, boy, if he thinks a loaf of barley bread something, I got 300 men. Suddenly 300 men doesn't look so bad, right? Well, we're better than a loaf of barley bread. Okay. And so Gideon hears it and he bows down in worship. He says, God, that was great. They're already afraid. Thank you. And he rushes back up to tell everybody about the unstoppable loaf of bread, right? But the fear from an army of 100,000 swords was dispelled by one word from the Lord. One word. It doesn't even necessarily make sense, you know? The whole dream and the interpretation is like, wow, Daniel never came up with something like that. That was an amazing interpretation of the dream, right? But God has put such a fear into their hearts already that Gideon's coming. The sword of the Lord is coming. And when he comes, we're not going to be able to stand against him. He could throw grenades of bread in our midst and it'll knock our tents flat. Okay, so he returns to the camp of the Israelites and he says this, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands. And so then he divides the 300 men into three companies. Of course you do, because, you know, 300 is too much. So we're going to split them up. And he puts trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them with torches inside the pitchers. And the reason they had that many was because they started with 32,000. These trumpets, by the way, would have been like the battle trumpets of the different companies. And I don't know what their percentages are, but I promise you, if they only had 300 men, they would have had like one trumpet. God needed 300 trumpets for his plan. That's why he brought 32,000 people there. But he says, I don't need you. I just need your trumpets. The rest of you can go. And so everybody picked up the trumpets and the pitchers and the torches, and they have 300 men armed to the teeth with trumpets, pitchers, and torches. He says, look at me and do likewise. Behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you will also blow your trumpets, and you will shout for the Lord and for Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him went to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, about 2 o'clock in the morning. And when they had just posted the new watch, so everything's fresh, right? They blew the trumpets and smashed the pitchers that were in their hands. So they have torches underneath the pitchers, and as soon as they smash them, all of a sudden the whole place lights up. So they position themselves all the way around the camp as far as they can go. So what's happening in the Midianites is they hear this loud crash, and suddenly, poof, lights everywhere. and it freaks them out. Then 300 companies blew the trumpets, broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right. So they don't have any weapons, by the way. They have a torch and a trumpet. That's it. That's all they need, right? Because it's easier to fight the battle when God does all the fighting. Each stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran, crying out as they fled. Oh my gosh, the sword of God, Gideon, is upon us. They started running. That fear which had started caught full hold, and they start running. When the Spirit of the Lord is present, the army of our enemy gets confused. And this is the thing, no matter how big the enemy is against you, God has a way of confusing them, and all of a sudden they don't see anything anymore. They get so afraid because they live in fear. The enemy, you know, they use fear. The enemy uses fear. That's one of his favorite tools to motivate people. And we felt it because we felt the attack of the enemy. You felt fearful before, haven't you? And you just like an unreasonable fear almost comes over you, and you can't explain it. Well, that's the enemy attacking with fear. Fear is really great for driving people, but it's not good for getting them where you want them to go. And so when fear takes over, this army doesn't know what it's doing. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against the other throughout the entire army. They start fighting each other. They were so panicked that someone was in their way. Now must be Gideon, and he starts swinging a sword. They start fighting each other. This must have been hysterical for the 300 guys holding the torches. You know, they probably at this point can't even blow their trumpet. They're laughing so hard. Watch this. They're killing themselves. This is ridiculous, but this is what happens when that loaf of barley called the Spirit hits the army. You know, it just gets confused and starts attacking itself. So this is the picture, a topographical map. If you see a little circle up there, that's where the battle takes place. So they had come up. Now, they came up here very quickly because they had strongholds in all the major cities all along the Jordan. They had taken over this area. This area was given to the Israelites as the promised land, but the Midianites and Amalekites had taken over. So they had strongholds, they had princes put in place, and so when they went to march, they went specifically against Gideon because they heard he tore down the altar of Baal. You know, so this upstart needs to be put down. So they went there to teach him a lesson. So they gathered 132,000 men to attack the weakest tribe of Israel, and they marched up against them. So what happens next, you see that yellow, you know, line? That's their retreat. They don't stop at their strongholds. They run all the way back to Midian, or they try. They're scared to death of these crazy Israelites, you know, who are attacking them. And so they start running. As they come down through here, they pass through this area called Ephraim. Now, Ephraim was one of the tribes of Israel. This was actually descendant of Joseph. And they had the best land. In honor of all the work Joseph had done, they had the best land. You can kind of see that in the topography here. They had this like sloping, nice hillsides, like, you know, on the grain and the grapes of Italy, like southern Italy. That's how this is laid out. It's like really nice, gentle slopes. They have great, rich, fertile, because this is where all the Jordan's coming. They have all this wonderful, wonderful place. And they did not lift a finger to help Gideon. They were not one of the ones who came forth and offered people. They're just sitting here. And that's where the biggest stronghold was. And so as they go running by, the Gideon and his whole army of 300 men, you know, screaming like banshees, are chasing them. The men of Ephraim were summoned. And they would say, hey, we're chasing the Midians. They're running. So they go, and they took them as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan, and they captured the two leaders of Midian. So they actually captured the princes of Midian, which is a big deal because these are the leaders of the entire army. But watch what happens next. The men of Ephraim said to him, what is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against the Midian? And they argued with him vigorously. They're angry with him because he didn't let them participate in the glory of the battle. I believe they were called, they just didn't come. But now they're angry. And you know why they're angry? Because all the way up from where that battle took place all the way down to where they are was plunder. These guys were leaving everything behind. And the armies that was chasing them was gathering up all kind of goods. You know, there was gold, there was silver, there were weapons, there were camels, right? So this is all plunder. So Ephraim doesn't care about the glory or the fight. They're saying, you know, hey, how come we don't get any of the good stuff? What's going on here? And so they're angry with him. They're saying, well, you didn't include us? Why didn't you include us? It's amazing how people who don't lift a finger to fight the battle or still want to share in the victory get used to that, by the way. It's just the way it goes. And I think a lot of people have been there. You know, they won't lift a finger to help you, but boy, when it's successful, all of a sudden, you know, they're there with their hand out, never stops. But Gideon, he shows some real leadership here because he could get really angry with them. I would have lost my cool at that point, you know. Instead, he says, look, What have I done now in comparison to you? Watch what he does. He appeals to their ego here. Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than a vintage in Abizir? What he's saying is, where I'm from, our vintage crop, by the way, it's a bumper crop. That's the best crop you can have, the vintage, because you have them ripe enough to actually make wine out of them the same season. It's a big deal if you have a vintage crop. He says, our vintage crop is not as good as the gleaning of your crops. Gleaning is what you do after you already harvested and you go back to find more, you know, like all the trodden ones. He's saying, if we have the best crop ever, it's still not as good as the gleaning of your crop. You guys are great. You have the great fertile soil. You have great lands. You have everything. And more than that, look, the leaders of Midian are in your hands. You got the princes. When everybody tells this story later, you know what they're going to talk about? Talking about you guys grabbing those princes. Yeah, you guys got all the glory. And you already have all the grapes. So what more do you need? And when he tells them that, they say, oh, okay, he's right. Yeah, we're bad. That's right. That's right. That's right. We're the best. Okay. And they let him go, right? And so he says, now, excuse me, I still have to chase the Midians. And he does. He chases them. And no one helps him, by the way, including Ephraim. They all just sit back. So whatever great thing you ever achieve in life, someone will always be there to take the credit. Just get over it. And part of that is you have to realize if you're fighting God's battle, you're fighting for God anyway. I had my brother asked me some time ago. We had a really great service here. And it wasn't, what was really great about it wasn't my sermon that day. Not always, but that day, it wasn't my sermon. It was something else that happened that was really great and moved a lot of people. And my brother asked me, he says, well, you know, it's kind of nice I got to come here and see this service, but, you know, it wasn't the sermon, you know, it was this. And I said, you know what? We have a motto here. It doesn't matter who gets the credit as long as God gets the glory. I don't care. The Spirit was here. I don't care. I don't care if I speak. I'm fine with just the Spirit coming. I just want to see people touched. That's all. I want to feel it too. And so as long as you have that attitude, look, all I care about is God gets the glory. Paul says that when they're trying to get him all upset about this other guy who's around preaching. He says, is Jesus being preached? Well, I don't care that. All I care is that. All I care is that Jesus is being preached. God's getting glory. That's all I care about. You want to take credit, you go ahead. Because I know it was all God anyway. You can go ahead and try to take God's credit if you want. Good luck with that. So anyway, just three quick lessons and we're done. Number one, God will not use us greatly until we've learned to trust him completely. Until he had Gideon to the point where Gideon was out of excuses and okay, I'm going to trust you. And that took showing him a miracle, whatever it takes. He had his total trust and he says, okay, now we can do something. Because there's no way Gideon would have let 32,000 people shrink down to 300 unless he totally trusted God. I don't know what you're doing, God. Doesn't make sense to me. But I totally trust you, so I'm with you. And I've talked about this before, and I'm sure I'll talk about it again, because I believe one of the biggest problems that happened in modern-day Christianity is we've confused trust and faith. And we, as a modern Christian community, have sought faith in our lives, and we forgot about trust. And the reason I say that is because the way we define faith today in 2016 in America, I think most people's definition of faith is this: belief in something unseen and perhaps even unreasonable. That's faith. Trust is belief in someone or something based on a history with it. I believe God calls us to trust him. And what we do is we sit around praying for faith to land on us like pixie dust, and we forget to live the lives of trust that we need in order to get ready to fight the battles. And the illustration I gave last night is, you know, if someone came up to me and said, I think Victoria's cheating on you, I wouldn't believe them because I trust her. We've been together now for 14 years. You know, I know her really well. When I first married her, you know, went to another country, we met, and I brought her here, I had faith in her. If someone had told me before we got married, I think she's going to cheat on you, I would say, I don't believe that. I have faith in her. But I didn't have trust because we were just getting married. Now, after 14 years, I have trust. You see which one's stronger? You know, because I have a history with her. And even if something looked weird, I'd still give her the benefit of the doubt and talk to her about it because I just trust her. Right? I have 14 years of trust with her. And so that's what God wants us to develop with him. He says, I want you to have trust with me. I want you to trust me. Can you trust me? And what we do is we sit around waiting for faith to hit us instead. But we have to trust him completely before he can use us greatly. Number two, your weaknesses never surprise God. Don't let that hold you back from what God's calling you to do. Yes, you're weak. Yes, you have faults. Yes, you have problems. That's okay. God knows that. He has a plan for it. Number three, do not wait until you think you're ready to fight God-sized battles, because, spoiler alert, you're never ready to fight God-sized battles. Right? So if we sit around and wait, I'm just not there yet, God. I need to get stronger at this. I'll start witnessing later. I'll do this ministry. I'll step up to this ministry some other time. I'm not there yet. God says, I know you're not there yet. You'll never be there. This is my battle. I just need you along. I need you to come with me. So we have to understand that what we try to do is we try to take the world's values and apply it to God instead of taking God's values and applying it to the world. And one of the world's values is this, is you need self-confidence. Isn't that what we teach our kids? If you have confidence in yourself, you can achieve anything. You can achieve anything in your life if you just have self-confidence. You will never win a God-sized battle with self-confidence. It won't work. You can't, because you can't have confidence to do it because you can't do it. That's called delusion, not confidence. If you're taking on a God-sized battle yourself without God, it's delusion. It's not confidence. Let me help you here. Self-confidence will never win battles that require God dependence. We need to stop thinking self-confidence and start thinking God dependence. God can accomplish it. If we're dependent upon Him, we win. Would you all please pray with me?